Well, it's that time on Summer Breakfast for Andrew West, who presents RN's Religion and Ethics Report. This week, Andrew's looking at some of the big ethical questions of 2016. Today, have we failed the people of Syria? A decade ago, the international community looked back on 15 years of war and violence, including a genocide in Rwanda and massacres in the Balkans, and asked itself why no one had intervened to save innocent lives. The crisis in Syria is equal to any of those tragedies. The UN estimates 400,000 people have been killed. 5 million have been made refugees, at least 6 million internally displaced. So is the Syrian civil war precisely the kind of conflict the United Nations doctrine called responsibility to protect, or R2P? Is that what it was designed to solve? Andrew West is speaking to Dr. Mark Kirsten of the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto, who explains how R2P started.
The idea came about when diplomats and states had to figure out how to square ethical problem in international politics. One being that we had to respect the sovereignty of states to make decisions for themselves as states, but also that we had to believe in and protect and espouse universal human rights as an international community. So how do you achieve those two things at the same time? Well, this idea of the responsibility to protect, which essentially says that states have a primary responsibility to protect their citizens from war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and ethnic cleansing. However, when they are failing, manifestly failing to protect their citizens from those types of mass atrocities, that the international community assumes that responsibility to protect those citizens and therefore should respond appropriately in ways to protect those citizens from those types of crimes. The most dramatic response, of course, being the use of force, the military kind of intervention in order to protect those citizens.
And Mark, this doctrine of responsibility to protect, it evolved essentially in the late 90s and early 2000s after the massacres in Rwanda, which the world turned a blind eye to, the massacres in the Balkans, which occurred, by the way, in spite of some United Nations peacekeeping presence. Those were the triggers, I understand.
Yeah, exactly. And in particular, actually, following the Kosovo intervention by NATO, which, if you recall, was deemed illegal but legitimate. So it broke international law in the sense that it was illegal given that NATO had intervened without a UN Security Council resolution permitting it to do so. However, it was seen as legitimate because it was an action done primarily in order to protect civilians and citizens in Kosovo from things like war crimes, ethnic cleansing, genocide, and crimes against humanity. And so this conundrum of squaring, can you intervene in these situations and how you intervene in these situations, kind of brought forward this need to have some kind of doctrine, and the response to protect was the result of precisely that.
So in your view, is or was Syria the type of conflict for which responsibility to protect was intended?
In principle, absolutely. It's undeniable that war crimes and crimes against humanity, and perhaps in some places even genocide and ethnic cleansing, are occurring on the territory of Syria. So you check the first box. What you also can check is clearly that there are no actors on the ground, be it the government, be it any rebel group, who are able and willing to protect those civilians and those citizens from those mass atrocities. So you have both of the kind of characteristics required for an invocation of the responsibility to protect by the international community. So yes, I think it is clearly a candidate.
Syria, though, is a very vexed case because, as you pointed out, you've got an Assad regime there that has all the firepower backed by Russia. It's using barrel bombs. It used nerve gas. But then on the ground, you do have this disparate group of rebels, some of whom are aligned to ISIS and Al-Qaeda affiliates, engaged in on-the-ground savagery. So where would a foreign power intervene there? On whose side?
Well, this is obviously the kind of conundrum that we've seen. We've also seen Syria as a location of kind of proxy wars, where we see Russia and other regimes like Saudi Arabia and Iran. Who do you intervene and how do you legally intervene? As I mentioned before, one of the key, some people would consider it a limitation, and it certainly is a limitation, but one of the core elements of the responsibility to protect as passed at the World Summit in the United Nations in 2005 was that, again, the sole legitimate dispenser of the responsibility to protect is the United Nations Security Council. And of course, what we've seen is that because of what's happening on the ground and the number of different warring parties and the difficulty of deciding whether there should be some kind of military intervention or not a military intervention, and the fact that the Assad regime can, for example, ask the Russians to help them, but won't ask the UN to intervene, of course. This all causes these kind of tensions that I think we've seen over and over again at the United Nations Security Council. And so the Council has essentially been unable to approve of any type of action in the name of the responsibility to protect in Syria. I think even more unfortunately, and a number of scholars and observers have started to talk about this, is given that it's been 5 years of, you know, regular mass atrocities on the ground in Syria, actually what the international community has a responsibility to do is say that R2P is not forthcoming to the people and the civilians and citizens of Syria. They're not going to be protected by the international community. I actually think that R2P in that sense can be expanded, that when we cannot or when the Security Council is unavailable to dispense or to invoke it whatsoever, we have a responsibility to tell these people that they will not be protected. I think it would change what they would think, and they would understand that it was entirely up to them. And we would stop working on the false hopes that I think many people have that over and over again, the Security Council might just find a way to help these people, might just find a way to protect these people, might just find a way to help and save the people in places like Aleppo. Unfortunately, to date, the Security Council hasn't been interested in doing that. It's instead been kind of interested in one side blaming the other for the situation on the ground in Syria, which I think everybody knows is a deep stain on the conscience of humanity.
This is RN Summer Breakfast, Andrew West speaking with Mark Kirsten of the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto about the failure of the responsibility to protect doctrine in Syria. Mark, you wrote recently that one of the major impediments to responsibility to protect working in a place like Syria was the debacle in Libya. What happened there? Because the West did intervene and Gaddafi was toppled. He was later killed in a fairly brutal way himself. But what happened there to dissuade countries from intervention?
Well, I think there what's important to recognize is that Libya was not a case for the responsibility to protect. What happened was that its proponents, its champions, RTP's biggest champions, the people who profess that it's this incredibly potent and important doctrine, really wanted to believe that Libya was a case for the responsibility to protect. But what happened, if you look closely at the actual wording and what the UN Security Council said, is it said that the government of Libya under Muammar Gaddafi at the time had the responsibility to protect citizens in Libya, which has essentially always been true. The world has always functioned on the idea that states do have responsibilities to their citizens to protect them under some means. However, the key second part of the responsibility to protect, as I've mentioned, is that the international community assumes that responsibility when the state is unable or unwilling to protect civilians. That is not what happened in the UN Security Council resolutions regarding Libya. Instead, what they said was, again, Libya has a responsibility to protect its citizens. Therefore, we authorize all necessary means and a military intervention, which then NATO and a couple of additional allies took up. Now, that really didn't kind of matter for the criticism of RTP because, again, its chief proponents had said this is a case for RTP. Then when things went awry, in a sense, in Libya, and it continues to be a situation that was recently described as broken and lawless, there's ongoing infighting and military violence and clashes on a daily basis, atrocities are ongoing. When its proponents claimed that this was a great case for RTP, because the Security Council had invoked it and was acting militarily, and yet all of these additional atrocities and forms of violence continued, or actually even grew to a large extent, it really did a lot of damage to the credibility of claims regarding the responsibility to protect. And I think states, including Russia, China to a lesser degree, looked at this and said, well, this is not a good case. They, I think, anticipated that, yes, Gaddafi in Libya would be removed from power, but that there would be some kind of stability and perhaps some sharing in the spoils of war in terms of the economy, oil and gas industry, and so on and so forth. What they've seen instead, what the world has seen instead, is Libya bordering on failed state status, really struggling to rebuild itself after the civil war, and RTP not being a particularly convincing doctrine for military action when it comes to these types of situations.
Yes, and Libya, even being a beachhead for the Islamic State, and we had that terrible occasion in the past year or so when there was a mass beheading of Christian Copts who'd been working across the border from Egypt. Just finally, Mark, is the situation with responsibility to protect, certainly its principal beneficiaries must be the people themselves, the innocent citizens, but does it have a responsibility, a duty to be neutral in terms of the warring parties, or can it take sides?
I think that's a very, very good question, which isn't one that relates perhaps directly or solely to the responsibility to protect, but actually what it means to be a humanitarian and to have humanitarian ambitions and feelings towards others, the desire to protect others. And you see this ongoing question with regards to humanitarian organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières versus the Red Cross. You know, is the best humanitarian one that's neutral? So, for example, one that will help everybody irrespective of what they may or may not have done in the context of war, or is it one that only helps civilians and rejects helping any combatants? This is a very important debate and discussion. With regards to the responsibility to protect, however, the primary focus must always be the civilians, the citizens who are vulnerable to the possibility of violence occurring within a state. And it doesn't have to be by a state, but within a state against them. And we're not talking about, you know, a number of murders or robberies or whatever. We're talking about the most serious crimes known to the international community. Again, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and ethnic cleansing. Those are crimes that don't happen between belligerents. They tend not to happen between belligerents. They happen to vulnerable peoples, minorities, groups that don't have the ability to fight back. And our responsibility to protect was really supposed to be about protecting those individuals. And if it has any future, it must continue to be primarily about those people.
Dr. Mark Kirsten of the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. Mark is also the author of the blog Justice in Conflict. Thanks for joining us on RN Summer Breakfast.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's Andrew West of RN's Religion and Ethics Report. Thanks so much to him for helping us review some of the really big ethical questions of the year. It's 5 minutes to 9.